Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 12th, 2014, and this is show number 492. I'm getting really, really excited about Lindsay getting married to a wonderful man named Nolan next Saturday. Now, why do you care about my personal life? Well, that is because it means you get a BART-produced podcast next week. Don't worry, it doesn't hurt my feelings at all how much you guys enjoy his shows and are kind of glad to get just a little break from me. Really doesn't bother me at all. But we do need your help. Please send in audio and text reviews to Bart so he doesn't have to do so much work. You can email them to me at allison@podfeet.com or to Bart at podcasting@bartificer.net. And of course, there's a link to that in the show notes. So you can get to that directly on that email in case you're driving, afraid you'll forget, or can't figure out how to spell Bartificer. In any case, get those to him early in the week so he doesn't stress out. That would really, really be great. So appreciate you guys doing that, giving him some help. We already got one transmission already. Well, this week I had two appearances. I got to be on the Daily Tech News Show again with Tom Merritt, where we discussed the HP breakup at length. I created a blog post to highlight the episode, so you don't have to go digging around for it if you want to go see it. Just go over to podfeet.com. It'll be up near the top somewhere. I like how Tom's shows are really crisp and to the point, start on time and end on time. It's an interesting and refreshing way to do a show. I also had the pleasure of presenting to the Dallas Apple Corps on the subject of digital disaster, life after death. Now, I didn't fly all the way to Dallas to do this. Instead, we did a Google Hangout on air, and it worked really well once we got the kinks worked out. There was an interesting challenge in doing a Hangout on air for this. I can flip between video of me, video of a single application, or video of my entire desktop in a Hangout on air. Now, if I flip over to Keynote and then go into a slideshow mode, it turns out the audience for the Hangout gets to see a big black screen. Not exactly what they're looking for. I did a quick search of the Googles, and I found a post by Ronnie Bintzer over in Google Plus where he explained a workaround to that. And I thought I'd tell you what it is in case you ever run into it. He said to share the entire desktop and then go into slideshow mode in Keynote, and then the audience will be able to see the slideshow just the way I see it. Kind of curious why it works, but I was delighted to get all of that working. The next challenge was that I like to see the audience because I love to be interrupted with questions during my presentations. Some people hate that. I love it. When Keynote kicks into slideshow, it makes the presentation full screen on one of my monitors and black on the other, which is super helpful. I don't know why they can't leave me that second screen to be able to put other stuff up on, but they don't. Steve solved the problem by bringing me his MacBook Air with the event live, but muted on screen. And that worked really, really well. It's a lot to juggle and remember to do, so I'm telling you about it in case you ever need to go do it. And I'm writing it down here, so I'll have a place to go look up the answer when I get lost the next time. The good news for you is that since I did it as a Hangout on air, that meant YouTube recorded it. And if you'd like to see the presentation, you can, or if you want to send it to any of your friends so that they know the things they should do to take care of their digital life in case something happens to them. Again, there's a separate blog post just on that. If you were at Macworld and saw me do it, you don't need to go see it again. Actually, it's got a few enhancements going on to it, but it's kind of interesting to see how it worked with a live audience. But in any case, go check that out over at podfeet.com. Last week on the show, Renee Ritchie was telling me that I could add and modify widgets on my iPhone and iOS by pulling down from the top of the screen and tapping on the edit button. I told him I didn't have an edit button. And luckily, I was on video chat with him. You guys couldn't see it, but I was on video chat with him, and I proved it to him. I showed him my iPhone, and there was no edit button. He was stumped and said he'd make it his top priority to find out why. How cool is he? Anyway, after we recorded, I wanted to show Steve the problem, and I had an edit button. I was really glad that I had actually showed it to Renee, so I had a witness that it was not there, but I was baffled why it showed up. Of course, I tweeted about this mystery. Between my tweet and people hearing the show, Chris Morrison, Clive Hammett, Steve Mandala, and Philip Richardson, and probably even a few more people, all wrote to me to tell me that I must have been on the lock screen the first time I tried to do it. Sure enough, I am able to replicate this behavior by locking and unlocking my screen. With the screen locked, you do not get an edit button, which makes perfect sense. Thanks to everyone who helped me solve this mystery. Well, let's take a little intermission here to hear a quick announcement from Kirshen Sia.
Hello, fellow Nocilla Castaways. Kirshen Sia here from freerangecoder.com. Just a reminder that Ada Loveless Day is coming up on Tuesday, October the 14th. It's a celebration of women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Anyone can join in by putting up a blog post or tweet about a woman they admire in STEM. This will help encourage more women to join in careers in technical fields. For more information, visit Ada Loveless Day's website, findingada.com. Once again, this is Kirshan Sia from freerangecoder.com, and I'll see you in the Bitstream.
Hey, Kirshan, nice to hear from you again, and I'm glad you reminded us about Ada Lovelace Day. I will have to think about who an appropriate woman to write about would be. You've been hearing me review Bluetooth headsets for the last few months, and while the Jabo Sports Plus wireless Bluetooth headphones work great for Steve, no matter what ones I try, they work fine until I put my iPhone in my spy belt, which is how I carry it to jog, wash the car, walk the dog, all those kinds of things. So if I hold it in my hand, the Bluetooth headphones work, but as soon as I put it in the spy belt, boom, I can't hear it at all. I don't know why it works for Steve. It doesn't work for me. I thought maybe get my new iPhone 6, it would have a better Bluetooth radio, but that didn't fix anything. I do still like the Avantri Jogger Sports Bluetooth headphones I talked about when I'm watching podcasts on my iPad at the gym, because I can set my iPad on the little table in front of you while I'm on the elliptical. But as soon as I use them with my headphones, with my iPhone, again, they cut out as soon as the iPhone touches my body in any way. Well, I decided that after testing so many Bluetooth headsets, wired was the only way to go for me. I guess I should mention the problem to be solved here, why I wanted Bluetooth headphones. First of all, it's not high audio quality I've been looking for. It's simply that the wires bang around hitting my hands when I'm jogging, or they get caught on the rearview mirror when I'm washing a car, or they get pulled when two adorable white labs jump up and yank my brand new iPod Nano off my shirt and crack it. Well, that didn't have anything to do with my iPhone, but that did happen, of course. Well, I thought about just wearing my iPhone headphones so the wire went down my back instead of in front and maybe down the back of the inside of my shirt or something like that, but the wire pulled the headphones out of my ears because they're designed to stay in your ears by pulling downwards in front. Then Kim Landwehr posted in our Google Plus community. You really should join it over at podfeet.com/Google Plus. Awesome community. Anyway, she posted that she was looking for earbuds that would stay in her ears when she gets sweaty while working out. Bart responded that he's been really happy with the Sennheiser PMX-685i headphones. I took a look at them and I realized those might be exactly what I needed. The Sennheiser PMX-685i's, it's a mouthful. Anyway, the Sennheisers wrap around the back of your head and sort of just suspend themselves in your ears. Since they come in from the back, I thought they might just tolerate having the wire go down my back instead of in front. I was also pleased that they were in my price range as well at $50 on Amazon. I've mentioned a few hundred times that I'm not an audiophile, so when we got the Sennheiser PMX-685i's, I handed them straight to Steve, who somehow found some music on my iPhone. I don't know how that happened, but anyway, he was immediately impressed with these Sennheiser headphones. For earbuds, the sound is fantastic, so much better than any of the Bluetooth headphones or the Apple EarPods. I know that's not setting the bar real high, but they do sound really, really good, and they're still just little earbuds. And let's see, I'm delighted with the fit and comfort of the Sennheisers. Like I was hoping, they're super light, and I can barely tell that I even have them on. They have the necessary iPhone controls on the wire, you know, volume up, down, microphone built in, and you can play, pause your audio, and answer the phone. I did a test the audio on a call to my daughter, Lindsay, and she said it sounded just fine. Sennheiser includes a little clip for the wire that turns out to be super useful, especially for me to keep the wires running down my back. I can easily clip them with one hand on the back of my shirt, giving me a nice service loop to move my head without ever feeling the wires pull, which is something that bugs the crud out of me. Just as I'd hoped, having the wires down the back does not pull the headphones out of my ears, and they're tolerant of my level of sweat, and they sound fantastic. The wires might be a smidge too long for me, but I just fold the wire once or twice into the spy belt, and it's all good. They did come with two of those little earmuff thingies. I don't know what you call them, those little black fuzzy things you stick on the earbuds. And they feel much better with those on. But unfortunately, one of them fell off and I lost it already. So I'm kind of annoyed by that. I still don't mind them for a fair length of time. But after about an hour, they start to irritate me on that one side. So I'm thinking of hunting around. I've got to have some of those laying around because every headphone I've ever bought seems to have come with some of those that I never used. Anyway, I can really recommend the Sennheiser PMX 685i Adidas Sports In-Ear Neckband Headphones. That's the full title. And of course, I included my Amazon affiliate link all over this blog post, so if you want to go get them, you can. I've heard a lot of people say that we're too connected these days and that what we're missing is real human interaction. For the most part, I disagree with that. Because of the internet and social media, I've got friends all over the world. I mention the usual suspects often, but there's so many more that I don't often mention. Here's an example. My decision to buy the Olympus OMD EM10 camera was largely driven by Stephen Getz. Stephen is a listener to the podcast, a camera enthusiast, and someone who really enjoys helping other people spend their money. And he found me a likely candidate. But he researched options for me, advised on lens choices, and pretty much goaded me into pulling the trigger and buying the camera. Stephen lives in Canada. I consider him a friend, and yet we've never met. I could describe a lot of other wonderful people from the internet who help me every day, who enrich my life, and whom I've never met in real life. Some people say, well, it's not the same. And they're right about that. In some ways, I share more with people I don't know in meet space. Bart is one of my closest friends with whom I've shared more than I have with my real friends, quote unquote. And yet we didn't meet for the first 4 years of our friendship. And that was only a brief visit a few years ago. I'm a little more guarded with my real life friends than I am with Bart. In spite of these wonderful side effects, there definitely is a downside, and it's that Facebook is, in particular, is ruining my real-life encounters with friends and even family. Here's an example. I get to see our son Kyle pretty often, but it's actually hard to find subjects for conversation. For example, I'll say, hey, Dad and I went on a bike ride on Wednesday, and he'll say, yeah, I know, you saw a radio-controlled airplane and you had a really nice omelet down on the beach. He knows this because Steve and I each posted on Facebook how much fun we had. And no, we did not take a picture of the omelet. But yes, Steve did take a picture of the radio-controlled airplane. Because Kyle follows us on Facebook, we have nothing to talk to him about when we meet in real life. Here's another even more surprising example. This week, we met up with some friends at a bar for a trivia night. Do not ask how my team did. I don't want to talk about it. Among the folks there was an acquaintance I haven't spoken to in probably, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years. She's really into crafts, so I started to tell her about a really cool Christmas stocking I'm cross-stitching for Lindsay and Nolan that has the alphabet and candle and characters like M is for mistletoe. Before I could get half the sentence out, she says, yeah, I know, you're on Y is for Yule log now. Seriously, I don't ever speak to this woman, but I do post a photo of each letter as I finish it on Facebook. So, I had nothing to talk to her about either. Kyle says it's because I overshare, which could be true, but I'm only posting 1 or 2 times a week to Facebook, and yet I seem to have lost the ability to have interesting conversations with people in real life. I'm not sure what to do about this because I do like to be able to share with my friends and family and even listeners to the podcast about my real life. So I guess the only solution is to stop hanging out with real life friends and family. Now that I've officially moved over to 1Password from LastPass, I wanted to help others, so I decided to make a clarified tutorial on how to do it safely. One step of the migration bothered me. Step one is to export your most precious passwords to an unencrypted text file on your desktop. Now, I know you can delete it when you're done, but if someone nefarious got hold of your Mac at a much later date, it would be child's play for a sophisticated hacker to get the data back. Not exactly what we're looking for. Now, I had started making the tutorial, and I realized I needed a step before step one. And that step is to do as George from Tulsa has taught us, and taught us a long time ago, create an encrypted disk image using OS X's built-in disk utility. I had already used Clarify 2's step numbering, so when I inserted a step ahead of step one, all of the steps renumbered themselves perfectly. I wanted to make the tutorial a little easier to follow, too. I used Clarify 2's new feature that allows you to create sub-steps. I was able to break the tutorial down into 4 major steps that kind of made it seem less daunting of a task to perform. You know, it wasn't just this long ream of stuff to do. It was here's step 1, 2, 3, and 4, but here's these little things you need to do inside each one. Now, I'm not done with the tutorial yet because Pat Putnam has discovered a slight inconsistency between how browsers handle saving of files, and I want to clear that up before I publish the tutorial. It'll be easy to edit and modify the instructions after we figure this out, and then I can easily push a button to post the tutorial to the web. If you haven't upgraded to Clarify 2 yet, I think auto-step numbering and sub-steps are 2 great features that make it worth the money. Check out the free trial over at clarify-it.com and see for yourself. that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. Are you ready to host the show next week, Bart?
Ready. That's an interesting word. I will be hosting the show next week.
Well, luckily we have one transmission already, right?
We do. Thank you to Ken Wolf from the Manhattan Repertory.
Repertory. I always have trouble saying that.
It's a difficult word.
I want to add more syllables.
Yeah.
Anyway, he has a lovely transmission. We need more from you guys so that Bart doesn't have to do all of the heavy lifting himself. So send in some recordings, I would say by early in the week so he doesn't have a heart attack. You can send him stuff later, but that just makes his life more fearful.
Well, it just means I might do too much work and then end up with a four-hour show or something.
Right.
Maybe.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and tuck into Security Light this week, shall we?
Okie dokie. Just one important update crossed my radar in the last 2 weeks, which is that our friends in Apple patched Bash, only they kept it very quiet because I have personally on one of my Macs not installed it in anticipation of it showing up in software update. I have now been waiting for 2 weeks. I have not seen it yet.
So it's there, but it's not being pushed to us because they're assuming you probably don't need it.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a particularly good excuse. Right,
well, it's not an excuse, it's a strategy.
But I don't think it's even a good strategy, because this thing doesn't require a reboot. It's a tiny little update.
Huh.
Yeah, okay, so exploitation is difficult at the moment, because no one has yet found a way to trick Bash in OS X in its default configuration. But the vulnerability's there, so when someone finds a way to reach in, it will suddenly become a problem, or it could suddenly become a problem. All because I didn't push a couple of kilobytes of a trivial patch at people. It makes no sense.
Just why not? There's no downside to pushing it to us.
Now, maybe it'll be in 10.10 that comes out later in the month. Maybe it'll just be in there by default. I'm certainly going to be checking its version of Bash when it comes out. But it still seems silly to me to release a patch and then not bother releasing a patch.
Yeah. Probably not doing us any harm right now because we probably don't need it. But why not, but, like you say?
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it seems silly to me. Anyway, that's Apple's choice.
And that's only security update this week. Wow.
That crossed my radar. God knows what I've missed. loads of news, though. Loads of news. So, the American law enforcement have just lost their reason, utterly and completely, about the fact that Apple have introduced security in iOS 8. They are just... Every cliche you can come up with to show that they have lost all contact with reality, that has happened.
What part of security is it that they've done that's got them out of their minds?
The fact that iOS 8 it encrypts the phone by default so that our phones are not horribly exposed to criminals.
Or the NSA.
But they seem to think that if you would like to keep something private, that means you're a criminal. And there was a police chief who actually said, because of this new feature, the iPhone is now the phone of choice for pedophiles, which is horse poop. There has been a lot of very wise writing on this topic, and none of it from members of the American intelligence agencies. But I have sort of picked one as being, I think, the... It has the best mix of not being too long and being very good.
Okay.
There are better pieces that are longer. So the one I've chosen is by Bruce Schneier, who is sort of a guru of the security world. And so I think Bruce's post is entirely human readable and not too long. So I've linked that one in the show notes and people can have a read.
Now, one thing I had a question about, I know when Tim Cook talked about the new encryption features, mm-hmm. he sort of poked Google in the eye about it.
He didn't really poke them in the eye so much about the encryption. What he poked them in the eye about was their business model. Google are in the business of selling our information because they are an advertising company.
But
Apple are in the business of selling devices. He did sort of mention the encryption. And the thing is, Apple are ahead of the curve in that because Google have, after Apple's announcement, Google said, oh, we're going to do that in L. Great, good.
I thought that part of what, what's his name? The grown-up. The grown-up at Google, not the two boys who started it. But his name?
Schmidt?
Schmidt, yeah. Eric Schmidt said that they already did do what Apple's doing as far as encryption.
Okay, in the case of iOS and in the case of Android, I believe we can encrypt, but it is not the default.
Okay, maybe that's what he was referring to.
Eric Schmidt's rebuttal, if you'll call it that, to Tim Cook's interviews was laughable. he tried to claim that Google was not in the business of selling people's data.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, if you're going to lie to, if you're going to assume we are all that stupid, I'm not going to pay attention to you.
Yeah, because if that's not their business model, where are they making money?
And I can go to their filings and I can see what their business is. They're an advertising company. They sell us. That is their business strategy. And just own it. Be honest. Don't think we're all stupid.
Yeah. There was something else that bothered me about that. One thing in their favor is that supposedly you can go in and see exactly what they're selling about you and turn things on and off.
Sure, they have privacy controls if you're prepared to spin and poke around.
Yeah.
I find Apple's much easier. I turn off iAds, I'm done.
So you pretty much pay us a fortune for the hardware, and then that's yours, and then we'll just let's move on and do business, right?
But that's a good business model, right? I am the customer. I am the one they're trying to keep happy. I want to be the one they're trying to keep happy.
I would also say that the other is also a good business model. It might not be what you want to invest yourself in, but it's a great business model, right? It has been shown to be highly profitable, and we get value for that, right?
Right. I have a slight uncomfortableness with it in the sense that I don't think they're very upfront about the fact that that is their model.
Right. I think that's erroneous.
I just think, you know, okay, if you're saying to people, in exchange for a part of your privacy and you get some control over that, here's some free stuff. That's what they're doing, but they don't say that.
Right. They try to act like it's just because they're altruistic and do no evil, right?
Yeah, and that's not... I don't like that. I don't like when people aren't truthful.
Yeah.
Or the whole truth, as it were.
Right. Own it, like you say.
Yeah. The EFF, I'm afraid we're still not done dinging US police departments. The EFF released a warning about a piece of what they're calling malware, which is, I think, the kindest interpretation is that it's malware. You know, malware, which they say police departments are naively distributing to parents in the name of protecting their children. And saying it's done naively is the kindest thing you can say. This thing was written by an ex-cop. It is spyware. It has a keylogger which sends stuff to the internet unencrypted. So it's actually exposing all of your stuff.
Are you serious?
Yes. And they call it computer cop. And they pretend that it's going to save you on the internet. And police departments give this on CDs to parents and pressure them into installing it on their kids' computers.
Oh, geez. To be fair, I cannot believe that across the board, the police officers realized this was doing what they think it's or what it's actually doing.
I don't think your average officer has a clue, but there's
someone
a certain
somewhere
whiff.
Encouraged them.
There's a whiff of impropriety about this, including if the EFF are to be believed, and I generally do believe the EFF. Mm-hmm. The company has a history of false endorsements. They say things like the Department of Homeland Security endorsed this, and when reached out for comment, it's like, we did not endorse this. We have nothing to do with this.
Wow.
That kind of stuff sends a smell to me. Now, I don't remember which U.S. government department it was. It may not have been HSS, but it was a major government department which gave them kudos, which they didn't actually have.
So
I don't like
that. I'd like to be generous here and say that the computer cop people are obviously slime balls doing something we don't want them to do, and that someone probably, without understanding how the internet works, got a hold of this and said, wow, we should have a program where all police officers should push this on parents.
Yeah, and it's...
And not understanding what
they did. It's not a nationwide thing, so it's sort of a per police department thing, and a whole bunch of them have bought in.
They can't have known. I mean, that...
I hope not,
because it's not like
right?
the police department's benefiting from it. These slime balls are, right?
Yeah, so I'm prepared to take that there is... Oh, well, somebody think of the children and some naivete combined to make this go. I mean, I think that's realistic.
Yeah.
But either way, I don't like it. And there have been a bunch of police departments who have pushed back and basically called out the EFF for endangering kids for reporting on this stuff. And that makes me feel real ick.
Yeah.
So, Computer Cop, as I say, the link is there to the EFF's report. If you're concerned, have a read of what the EFF have to say about it. It's probably the best thing to say.
I've just been glancing at this. Yeah, that definitely looks like a good read. All right. What next depressing news do you have for us, Martin?
Some good news. Oh. I've sort of peppered it one to the other, just in case we get too depressed. So Apple's two-factor auth on iCloud goes into effect today as we're recording, which is good. But it also means that if you are using a third-party app to access your calendar or your mail, that is hosted in iCloud, you need to set up an app-specific password, because if the third-party app doesn't support the 2FA, you can't get in. It's not a big deal, but it's just a PSA.
Sounds hard.
No, it's a once-off thing. It's the same as on Google's thing. You just basically, you set this giant Uber mega password for your mail client, and then you just copy and paste it into your mail client, which saves it, and you're done.
Okay.
And because it's a giant Uber mega password, it is safe.
I signed up for the two-factor authentication on iCloud, and then you have to wait 3 days.
I know.
For it to go into effect. So I thought it was available like a week and a half ago, because by the time my authorization came through, I chickened out and didn't do it.
Oh, no, it's been available as a service, but it's now also protecting iCloud. So it used to just protect your money. Now it's also protecting your data.
Oh, okay. Do you have it on for protecting your money?
Oh, I've had it on for my money for a very long time. I have multiple Apple IDs, so I have a bit of work to do to get all my ducks in a row. But they're almost in a row.
Okay, I guess that's not a depressing one.
No, it's not. No, it's good news.
The next one is.
The next one, unfortunately, is less good news. So it was discovered that Adobe Editions, which is an e-reader app that is used by a lot of public libraries, was just sending home all of your reading stuff to Adobe in the clear, unencrypted. Which is just plain old nuts.
This is what book you're reading and how far into it, how many pages you've read?
Yeah. It's just a stream of information about your reading habits. Now, you might say that's innocent enough information, but if you're reading books on, say, democracy in Iran, that could be quite a dangerous leak.
Yeah. This and is because one of those it's things that sounds fine as long as you're not under a totalitarian regime or something.
Yeah. And even within a non-totalitarian state, it is perfectly acceptable to do research on things you utterly and completely detest and disagree with. An idiot looking at your logs may decide that you are actually a jihadi because you're reading up on this stuff.
Right. It's very of trying to understand or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's very easy to mistake someone researching, someone being looking at stuff for being someone who is a something. It's very dangerous stuff. So it's very silly to have that kind of stuff going out, you know, unencrypted. The good news is Adobe have responded and said, here's what we send and here's why we send it, and we're going to do that whole encryption thing you mentioned.
Now, there was something in the original article about the Adobe Digital Editions thing that said that they were crawling the guy's hard disk and looking at everything on his disk and sending it up or something like that, but finding other files and looking in them, but then that turned out not to be the case?
Well, certainly Adobe say that is not the case, and I haven't seen anyone prove it is the case.
I think the guy who wrote that article, or woman, I forget which, went back and said, yeah, no, it looks like I misunderstood.
Which is, yeah. So it seems it wasn't quite as evil as very first reports thought, which is good.
Just kind of icky.
Yeah, it's still silly, right?
Okay.
Then a giant big non-story which got all the media all happy, was that there was a big iWorm virus spreading on 17,000 Macs or 18,000 Macs.
That wasn't true.
Well, it was sort of true. It's just they only released a little bit of the information. And this is, again, one of those things where you can have an innocent explanation. They just didn't know, or they were really media savvy and this was Dr. Bot trying to sell more AV. You can make up your own mind on that. I'll leave that as an exercise to the listener. Anyway, what it turns out was, so we were told it on 17,000, or was it 18,000? Over 10,000 Macs have been infected with this iWorm. Now, worm implies self-propagating for a start.
Right.
But nothing said how the thing propagated, how the thing got in. Just that Dr. Bot's AV will fix it for you.
Oh, antivirus. I'm sorry. Dr. Bot makes audiovisual equipment as well. So I was getting really confused going, what? I put HDMI adapter on and it fixes it. Wow, that is good. Okay, antivirus. So Dr. Bot sells an antivirus. They were the ones that publicized it and said they could fix it.
Yeah. And then, and there was one thing slightly novel about it, was that it was using Reddit for its command and control. So we're used to stuff using IRC and stuff for command and control, but this was using a Reddit subthread thingy.
Yeah.
I don't really understand Reddit. It's just another way of communicating, right?
Okay.
It doesn't make it any more dangerous. It's just another way of sending information. And then over the next few days, slowly the facts trickled out. And it turns out that this thing is just a Trojan. It's not a worm. It's just a Trojan. It is some malware that installed itself along with pirated apps. Like we have talked about on this show literally years ago. There's no news here.
I love it when it's in pirated apps. It just makes me really happy. It's like, ha ha.
Cyber Darwinism. Yeah,
exactly.
So
there is no worm.
There is no worm. It's just a Trojan.
Don't download stuff you didn't buy.
Yeah, and Apple have added it to XProtect anyway.
What's XProtect?
It's Apple's little thing that keeps an eye out for known malware. I think there's 44 definitions in it. It updates daily behind the automatically.
It's running on all of our Macs?
It's been in OS X for at least the last two versions, possibly the last three.
Oh, okay. Great, great, great.
Then I'm afraid it's good news, bad news, flip-flop again. So do you remember bad USB?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the last time there was a researcher who demonstrated it but didn't release any code.
Explain what it was to people.
So the problem is that our USB devices all have a little computer in them. And that little computer actually has a decent little microchip and it can actually do stuff. And in theory, what you would want is that that computer will be programmed in a write-once way, and then you couldn't reflash the BIOS. But it's much cheaper to have it be electronically programmable. And rather than having a separate contact to program it, it's much cheaper to just program it through the USB interface.
Okay.
But if you can program it through the USB interface, you can reprogram it through the USB interface.
All right.
So you shove it into someone's computer. They run a little bit of software that pushes a malicious bit of malware or a malicious firmware into your USB device. You are now carrying around that malicious firmware and it's doing whatever its malicious thing is. Maybe it's a keylogger that phones home every time it has an internet connection. Maybe it sets up a hidden partition on your disk and starts spying on you and sticking all the stuff at a hidden partition that it'll then disgorge at a later point in some way. I mean, the possibilities are as endless as one's imagination. Basically, they can reprogram any USB device to do two things at once. Whatever you think it should do, and something else.
So when we last heard about it, like you said, this was just that they knew this could happen, but we didn't know anything else.
Yeah, so basically the guy demoed it, but didn't release any code.
Okay.
And an entirely separate research team basically went, well, okay, if this is possible, maybe we can figure out how it's possible. And so they started from zero and arrived at the same point as the previous researcher had arrived.
Okay.
But they decided that the security industry were ignoring it. Therefore, they would release a little bit more. And so they have released proof of concept code. Now, they have been very careful about what they've released. So they would argue they haven't given away the keys of the kingdom. They've simply made public what any skilled hacker could have done anyway. And if they can do it, the bad guys have probably done it already.
So does this mean all USB drives are suspect now?
Yes, I would say treat a USB device that is not yours, and it's not just thumb drives, it's all USB devices,
right.
Anything that has a USB plug, treat it like a floppy disk in the 90s.
So
don't stick it into your computer.
I wasn't afraid of anything in the 90s. I didn't know any better.
Really?
So, I've got a USB camera, and I buy it from Logitech. I go to plug it in. Should I not plug that in?
You're going to have to trust that the vendor has got things right, but I wouldn't... If someone at a conference walks up to you and says, oh, borrow my camera, the answer is no. If someone says, oh, just stick this thumb drive in, the answer is no, in my opinion. That is now the way we should treat USB devices from strangers. And maybe we should have always done that.
Yeah, I thought we had pretty much decided on that getting press releases from vendors on USB sticks was probably a bad idea.
Yeah, but now we need to expand that. So it's not just USB sticks, it's also USB anything. So if it has a USB plug and it's not we didn't buy it in a shop and it's not from someone we trust, maybe don't stick it into your computer.
Hmm.
Which, to be honest, is not a silly way to operate, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't panic. What was it someone said? Was it you who said this to me, your security posture should not be curved in a bowl screaming?
I was quoting somebody else, but I forget who said that. But yeah, that should not be your strategy.
Yeah, so don't put your hair on fire. Don't run around. Just be suspicious of USB devices from strangers.
Right, right. Don't take candy from strangers.
Kinda, yeah, to be honest. Digital equivalent to that. Don't take candy from strangers. And then don't panic, you're fine.
So anybody fixing this?
Everyone's arguing about what approach should be taken. Okay. We're at that stage, right? We now all know there's a problem, and now everyone's arguing about how to fix it.
And you can't really retroactively fix it, probably.
No, so I imagine there's going to be security software to scan for these kind of things, and then people are saying, well, maybe digital signatures on all USB devices, so they'll refuse to install firmware that's not digitally signed. Oh, but then that means that hackers, in the good sense of the word, can't play with stuff, and you're locking it down, and that's bad for young people doing cool stuff, and all sorts of arguments every which way.
People doing cool stuff, not young people doing cool stuff.
Well, as in, new generations can't learn, blah, 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 blah. And I think one of the simplest things I've heard was, well, a device should just have a hardware switch. If the switch is pushed, you can put new firmware on it. If the switch is not pushed, you can't.
Oh, that's a good idea.
An interlock. Problem solved. So, there's arguments always, and it's going to take... This is one of those, we'll watch it develop over the next few years.
Great. All right.
Put a pin in it, as they say. And a quick reminder that iOS 7 is not to be trusted now. There is a new bug has come to light. Basically, you visit a website, it sends a PDF, your phone is hacked. You really do need to update to iOS 8.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, a lot of discussion's been going on lately that Apple got up to, I think it was 46% a couple of weeks ago on iOS 8, and then it stalled out, and it only got to 47% by the next week. And people have been wondering what the cause of that is, and certainly the iOS 8.0.1 fiasco would be a contributor. But I personally think that the real reason is because nobody can fit it on their phone and they're not used to plugging it into iTunes. So they don't know what to do.
I agree. Yeah, no, I think you were absolutely right. And I believe John Gruber found the same. He assumed it was 10.8.01 or whatever 8.0.1. That buggy update.
Right.
8.0.1. Yeah, there's no 10. That's always 10. Anyway, he assumed that and wrote a blog post to that effect. And his email just got bombarded with people going, no, it's because I don't have 5 bloody gigs of free space. My phone only has 8 gigs of memory. How can I have 5 free gigs?
The only reason I even know that you could do it through iTunes, I completely forgot. It had been so long since I plugged my phone into iTunes, I forgot. So if I couldn't remember you could do it that way, normal people are not going to know they can do that.
Yeah, and I did my iPad that way. And then afterwards, I discovered that actually I had 10 gigs of movies on it I'd forgotten I put there.
Yeah. Well, anyway. My iPhone, I just sat there going, well, I guess I don't need you. I probably spent 2 hours getting crap off of it. And then by the time I was to my iPad, somebody went, hey, moron. You know,
plug it into iTunes.
Actually, no, I had done it on, that's right. I'd already done it on my iPad because I was in the developer program. So I had done it through iTunes because I was doing the weird developer-y thing. So.
Very good.
That'll be interesting. Well, Dorothy, you heard it from Bart here. You have to go to iOS 8 now. She's been holding back until the dust settled.
I think it's settled now. Touch wood.
Well, it's just mostly not that buggy so much anymore, except for keyboards disappearing and apps crashing. But okay.
I've actually found that more stable than 7 was. Oh, where's that wood gone again?
Oh, man. No, not me. My keyboards disappear all the time. I'll be in an app, typing away, and all of a sudden, it's just gone.
I used to get about 2 or 3 resprings a week. I've had one since iOS 8.
I haven't been getting the resprings at all, but I've been getting just app crashes. But it seems like the vendors are updating the apps and fixing some of the stuff. Like one of my favorite apps was Lumen. And I can't remember, by the way, whoever talked to me on Twitter about it and was really sorry and said that Lumen, maybe it was Donald Burr, might have been Donald. Lumen just would open and crash. They pushed out an update so it works again.
Whew. Well, that's good.
I live off Lumen. All right.
Okay.
Why are you taking so long to go through these, Bart?
There is just so much. Well, you're asking me questions, and there's a lot of news. Okay, so Apple have released a really cool thing, right? You're going to buy a secondhand phone. We now know you can lock it so the bad guys who steal it can't activate the phone. But what if the phone you're about to buy is stolen and you're about to pay someone $200 for stolen property you can never activate? Mm. Maybe you'd like to know that before you hand over your money. Now you can. Apple have released a website, iCloud.com/activationlock. You type in the IMEI number of the phone or the serial number, I think, are your choices.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's a device, IMEI or serial number. You type in the CAPTCHA, you hit continue, and it will tell you this phone is locked, this phone is not locked. If it's stolen merchandise.
Dumb question. Mm-hmm. Do we have to actively lock our phones?
At the moment, I believe we do.
So I probably haven't done that.
It's in the Find My iPhone settings, I believe.
Okay.
And it's a case of, so if you have your phone set to use Find My iPhone, then I believe that will turn on activation lock. And then I presume you can log in and click Nucrify, and that will keep it locked.
Nucrify. I think that's true because when I tried to set my phone up as a new phone, it said, you got to turn off Find Friends first.
Yes, that's exactly why it does that.
So I think it might be automatic because I haven't actively said, you know.
Well, I think it's if you use the Find My ... features.
Okay, as soon as you turn on Find Anything, then it's yours and you've locked it.
I think so. And I think listeners, you're right. If I'm wrong, shout at us.
Right. I actually just sold a phone to Dorothy. I'll have her check the activation status on the phone I just sold her and see if I did it right. Because I know when I did a full reset, it said, you got to turn off Find Friends first.
I presume by doing that full reset and not logging back in with your iCloud, that phone is now unlocked.
Right. I believe so. Yeah. And I did need Lindsay's password in order to undo it. I needed her iCloud account in order to undo it.
Yes, so if you tried to reset it without doing that first, you would have needed her details to get that phone to work again.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is good. That's
good,
how it should
good.
Be.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm sorry to say the last story, which is just last because it came in about 5 minutes before we started recording, so I put it at the end, is that HP are going to make life annoying for people who have old HP computers.
What?
They accidentally signed some malware. Whoops. So they have to revoke their cert, because otherwise that malware will show up as a legitimate driver on Windows.
Oh, no.
But that means that if you have... So they're releasing loads of software updates and people who are using their computers will be fine. But when your HP computer of a certain vintage blows up and you go to restore it from the original media they gave you or from that restore partition, you're going to have firmware and drivers which Windows is going to say are hacked.
Okay.
It may only, depending on how and what version of Windows, it's probably only going to frighten the living bejesus out of people.
But functionally work?
It still functionally work, but if Windows ever decides that it's going to just not allow the driver, so right now it'll pop up a warning and say, do you want to continue? But if in a future version it just plain old says, I'm sorry, it's not signed, go away, then all of a sudden you can't get your device drivers back onto your machine.
So just because that one device driver was malware and signed, then you can't install any of them?
Okay, right. So the cert that signed that malware has to be revoked.
So all of the, everything that has else, that cert.
Yeah, everything else that was signed with the same cert. Now, HP are at pains to say they never lost control of the cert. They just accidentally signed some malware with it.
But everybody goes when the whistle blows. So why does it only affect older computers?
I presume it's from whenever this cert... Apparently they discovered this had happened a while ago.
And that's an old cert, so the cert...
It's an older cert.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's a whole pile of oops.
I heard a really funny thing on Twitter. Somebody said that HP spinning off its PC and server enterprise business should name the personal computer business Compaq and the enterprise business DEC.
To pull them back apart. Yes, I like that. Actually, we had loads of DECs. They were beautiful green servers.
Yeah, DEC wasn't bad.
DEC were also, they had a big factory in Galway, Ireland. They were a big loss when they left here. Anyway, notable breaches. AT&T said that we had a bit of an insider problem. Please reset all your passwords. So if you're an AT&T user, you probably want to do that.
Note to self.
Dairy Queen. I have no idea what they do. I imagine they milk cows. They had 395 stores with the credit card breach.
They are an ice cream shop.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's really sad. I haven't seen one since I was in elementary school. I don't know if they're around here or not.
Well, there's 395 of them somewhere in your country. Wow. Anyway, needle in the haystack, if ever I heard one. Anyway, and then finally, the award for the biggest data breach I've ever heard of in my entire life goes to JPMorgan Chase. They lost the details. Now, thankfully, not the social security numbers and thankfully not the passwords, but pretty much everything else of 76 million households and 7 million businesses. Which makes Adobe's little 1.5 million whoopsie look very small and insignificant.
How did they lose these? Do we know?
Well, they call it advanced persistent threat. Basically, hackers hacked in and stayed there for a couple of months and got into about 90 servers.
Okay.
Now, for an organization signed at JPMorgan Chase, 90 servers is probably like 1% or something. But it's not good. And it is... really quite staggering, and there's all sorts of suspicions that it's Putin getting revenge for the sanctions and stuff, but that's all conspiracy theory stuff.
Okay.
The bottom line is the data's out.
Okay. Not using him as a password, so you can't really do a darn thing about it.
Apart from do some very convincing phishing attacks.
Mm.
If you get a phishing email that has your correct name, your correct address, your correct phone number, your correct email address, saluting you with the perfect title, the perfect name, it's so much easier to be tricked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just more of it. If they get 1% of 1% of 1% of people, they're going to have a really good day.
So if you have JPMorgan Chase as your bank, don't click any links that say reset your password. And if you don't have JPMorgan Chase, don't click any links that say reset your password.
To some extent, yes. But if you do have JPMorgan Chase, just be that extra bit more vigilant. And it's not going to happen straight away because these things tend to sit on this information for a couple of months. And then when you've completely forgotten that ever happened, have at it, you know, because then it's more valuable.
Don't click on links and emails that tell you to reset your password.
It's not just that,
password.
Be suspicious of email. Right? We'll leave it at that. Okay. Anyway, that is a lot of security news. There is a little bit more in suggested reading. I want to very quickly just mention the headlines. Last time, or the time before, we talked about Facebook causing an accidental problem with the real name policy and that having really bad side effects for people in the LGBT community.
Right.
They met, the LGBT community met with Facebook. Facebook went, oh, I see what you mean.
Oh,
and they've said that we're going to make this right. So they're going to change and it's going to be okay. So that
makes
was good.
Me really happy. You know, I mean, everybody's got blind spots, right? Of things
right.
you don't realize and that they were able to have an adult conversation and
yes.
figure it out. That I teared up a little bit at that, Bart. That's good.
It is good. And I put it first because I want to say good things about Facebook when they deserve it.
So it may never happen again.
It's happened a few times, right?
Okay.
The US FDA made my head like do a 360. They've looked into the security of medical devices and decided that it is very important, that it is necessary that they be secure, but it's optional. The regulations say that security is optional, but their study says it's necessary. Now, what corporation does more than they have to? Not very many. So security is really important and we think you have to do it, but you don't have to. So anyway, that made my head go, but
okay.
Cloudflare are giving everyone free SSL, even their free customers. So that's two thumbs up.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, because I was going to have to buy an SSL cert from Bluehost.
Well, you wouldn't have, because I would have told you how to get a free one from startssl.com.
Okay. But so Cloudflare, that's if you have your ISP.
Yeah, if you're hosting with them,
you're hosting
yes.
through Cloudflare. Oh, okay.
So that's nice of them. You know, Cloudflare have done quite a few things recently to make me look up and go, oh, that's interesting.
Okay, good.
And then finally, for all those Windows users who are being all smug about Bash, someone found a bug in the Windows shell. It's a little bit harder to exploit because the Windows shell isn't quite as tied into as many things. But if you have access to a server where you can make a folder with a name of your choice, you can probably hack that server.
Okay.
So that's an interesting one for people with Windows file shares. And really, there's other stuff here. Dubai Police playing 1984, all sorts of other stuff. But as I say, have a read. It's all in the show notes. And I want to end with something that is pseudo-security, very practical, so definitely light. So all of you who have iOS 8, your phones now have a feature that might save your life. It is called, it's part of health. It's called your medical ID.
Part of health.
Part of the health app. So if you go right. into the health app, you can set it up. So if you click on the little Love Hearty app, wherever it's gone here.
I do search for everything.
So you go into health, and then you will see that medical ID is sort of the icon at the extreme right of the bottom sort of bar thing
mm-hmm.
with a little star icon. You enter your details there, and now I happen to be allergic to a certain type of antibiotics, so it's very important for me to have that information there. So it says allergies and reactions, you enter your allergies and reactions, next of kin, you enter the details of your next of kin, your blood type, whether or not you're an organ donor, and if you want some more information, it's up to you how much you fill in. Whatever you put there is available from your lock screen while your phone is locked, so that an EMT who is attending to you after you've collapsed or something or been in a car wreck can slide to unlock, click the emergency button, and then click the medical ID button, and they can then see your blood type, they can see your allergies, and anything else you put in there. That really could save your life.
Yeah. You can also, within there, you can put in emergency contacts. I'm glad you
yes.
brought this up again, because I had done this on my first iPhone, but then I started clean and I didn't redo it. So you can add emergency contacts, blood type, whether you're an organ donor.
Yes, which I think is good.
Yeah.
So, you know, and weight and stuff. I think there's other stuff you can add too. But I basically have a thing against certain antibiotics, so I thought that was a good idea to have there.
Yeah.
And next of kin contact number I thought was important.
Yeah, why do I need my height and weight? If I'm laying there on the ground, weigh me. If you really need that information, because I'm going to lie. Yeah,
yeah, that I'm not so sure about. But the blood type.
I weigh 125 pounds and I'm sticking to that story.
I did also find out my blood type is only in 3% of the population, which makes me a little bit worried.
Really?
But anyway, yeah. Although I can take blood from about half the population. I just can't give it to any more than 3%.
Oh, well, that's the best possible.
Anyway, that's our vegetables well and truly eaten.
Okay.
And a little PSA to go with it.
All right.
So I promised you last time we would have a light taming the terminal.
Yeah.
To sort of cleanse our palate before we get into what is going to be a very fun but serious section of Taming the Terminal, which is networking. And the reason it's going to be serious is because the only way to understand the commands is to understand the network. Because if you don't know how the network works, how can you possibly execute commands to do same things with said network.
But that sounds fun to learn.
I promise you it's going to be entertaining, but it is at times going to be a little bit of vegetables.
A little thick, huh? A little thick.
It's going to be vegetable-y for a bit.
Okay.
So to preemptively cleanse your palate a bit, I figured we'd... there's lots of these little things that just make your life on the command line a bit easier, and there's never been a logical place to put them in, and so I've just been collecting them in an Evernote.
Oh, cute.
And I figured, right, okay, now's time. The Evernote is big enough. Let's do a show.
All right, cool.
So I've broken this into two halves. There's stuff that's relating to Bash, which means everyone can play along, and there's stuff relating to the OS X terminal app and to OS X only. So OS X does some stuff that Linux doesn't do.
Say everybody, you mean everybody on Linux or Unix of any variant?
Correct, including Cygwin on Windows, say.
Ah, right.
Anybody get Bash in Windows?
Okay.
So the first thing is, so we're starting off on Bash, and the first sort of topic for discussion is repeating previous commands, because you very, very, very often have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest way to do that is with !!!! If you hit that as a command, it will simply do whatever you did the last time again. So if you open up a terminal and type ls-al or something, hit enter, and then just go !!!! And hit enter again, you'll see it does exactly the same thing.
Okay. Interesting.
Now, so you'll notice that if you scroll back up, depending on how big a folder you did the ls-l in, you'll see that the first thing it does after !!!! is print out the command that evaluated to, and then it executes the command. So in my case, I see !!!! I hit enter, then I see ls-al, and then I see the results.
Right.
You don't have to use it on its own, right? You could go !!!! And then add in a few more flags. Or pipe it to another app. Basically, you can just use !!!! As a shortcut. So you might pipe that into wc-l to see how many things there are in your current folder. So !!!! Space pipe space wc-l. Hit enter. It'll see that it evaluates to ls-l pipe wc-l. And then in my case, it says 35. Because I'm in my documents folder, I think. And I have 35 folders in there. So handy little shortcut. So if you think back to when we were playing with find... If you're going to do something evil like delete all files that match a certain criteria, you would run it without the actually doing the delete bit first, make sure it finds every file you want and not a single file you don't want, and then do !!!, and then put in the scary minus exec. Right? Save your retyping.
Oh, okay.
It's handy. It's handy. But it lets you go back one step. But you kind of often want to go back more than one step. So that's where our good friend the up arrow comes into play. So if you hit the up arrow, you see the previous command. If you hit the up arrow again, the previous command. If you hit the up arrow again, the previous. And you can keep going back really for a very, 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 very long way.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you said !!!, I just kind of paused because I always use the up arrow. Why wouldn't I just use the up arrow?
You can. I do.
Well, but again, if you wanted to add more to it.
Exactly. It has its uses, and different people find different things memorable. So I figure we tell people all the different ways, and they'll do what they find funnest. So I use the up arrow far more often than anything else. Up arrow, enter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That's and then, one of the course, few things that's really intuitive and instinctual to me now. It's just like, oh, boop, done. Yeah.
And, of course, the other thing is if you go too far, the down arrow goes the other way.
Oh, it does?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
So if you, let's say you see what you wanted fly by because you've been holding down the up arrow for so long. If you hit the down arrow, you go the other way again.
I do it when I do a typo is what I use it for more than anything. It's I hit it, shoot, so I do up arrow, then
fix it. Do it again. Yeah,
especially no, it's very long.
And, you know, if I'm debugging some software or something, I'll have to hit the compiler again and again and again and again. It's just very handy. Up arrow, enter. Oh, still have an error. Up arrow, enter, you know.
Yeah.
So that is... Tray useful, as they say. There is one more way to go back in time, and that is actually to do so in a really powerful way. So don't just list them in order. Let me search them.
Oh.
And now this can get confusing, so you're going to have to pay attention here. So to go into this, you go into a mode, basically, which is reverse search of the history. And to go into that mode, you hit Control or. And then it will say, instead of your prompt, it will say reverse iSearch. And then there'll be a colon and two little quotey things.
Okay.
As you start to type, so just start to type, say, in this case, LS, because we did that a minute ago. What you type shows up between the quotey things before the colon.
Okay.
After the colon is the most recent matching command.
Okay, I see it.
And if you hit enter, whatever is after the colon gets plopped down. It doesn't get executed, so it gets dropped in as if you'd got there by hitting the up arrow 5 million times. Then you can edit it, and then you can hit enter.
I did control R, and then I typed L, and it wrote LS minus L. If I hit enter, it did execute it.
Oh, so it does. Excuse me. Yeah, okay, so it does execute it. Okay. You hit the up arrow then, and then you can edit it. Now, so to go back into that mode, so we go control R again, and we'd start typing. If you want to keep searching further back in time, hit control R again, and it will go the next match, the next match, the next match, the next match. And then control shift R will bring you back forward, and it's not working for me. Why does control shift R not work?
Yeah, no, it just goes one way. Oh, ooh, there was a big one. Oh, and that was interesting.
There is a way to go back.
It appears to be moving around within the command.
It jumps to wherever the match is. So sort of the cursory bit.
Oh, and I did a search for L. So that's why it's going.
It's going to see all the L's, yeah.
And I had typed Perl last pass, blah, 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 dot PL. So I have a whole bunch of L's. I'm like, what is it doing? Okay, there we go. Yeah. It appears to continue to cycle. I think it's cycling in a circle, Bart.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm seeing the same. I haven't typed that many things recently, I don't think.
Okay.
Oh, maybe not. No, I'm in some stuff we did weeks ago.
Oh, the history goes back a long way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's the command when you taught me how to find things bigger than 500 megabytes.
Woo! That's quite
so if I forget anything, I can just... Yeah, I don't type enough.
Seriously, it goes back a long way. It can be very useful.
Yeah, I'm going to run it
again. It's just a slightly clunky interface, the control or thing.
Yeah, a little clunky.
A little clunky, but it often saves your bacon. So... The next thing, then, is moving around inside a command. So if you hit the up arrow a few times, you get a great big long command. You can use the left arrow to very slowly make your way through the start of the line, if that's where your problem is.
That's what I do.
You can hit Control-A and jump straight to the start of the line.
Oh, now how can I remember Control-A? Control-A means all.
A is the first letter of the alphabet?
That might help. That might help. Okay. Yeah, because I need that. I sit there going...
I use that all the time. And the more you get into piping stuff, the longer your commands get and the more you're sitting there on the bloody left arrow, wait.
Because it's always to the left side of the pipe that you really want to fix something.
Exactly. So Control-A is a real lifesaver.
Just jumps you back.
Very simple, but very useful.
Control-A. Look at that. I want to remember that one.
That's kind of all I have in here for everyone. The other thing, of course, which I know we've mentioned in passing, but I'll just mention it. It's not actually in the show notes. Remember tab complete. And I know we've talked about it before, but just...
Explain it again, because it's the best thing ever. It's even better than that up arrow.
It is, actually. So as you begin to type a folder name or something, as soon as you've typed enough of it, that Bash knows that there can only be one option. If you hit the tab key, it'll just fill it all in. And if there isn't enough to fill it all in, if you hit the tab key twice, it'll show you a list of all the possibilities.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So if you type cd space slash and hit tab tab, it will show you everything in slash, and then you can continue typing. So if I do cd space slash tab tab, you'll see everything in slash. Then you might go into etc and then hit tab tab, and it'll show you everything in tab in etc. And you can keep building it up, and so you can find your way around.
So let me give the example that I was doing that I think people might really resonate to. Is I'm in my home directory, and I want to change to my desktop. So I type CD space capital D, and I hit the tab, and it bonks at me because there's desktop and downloads and Dropbox.
Yeah.
So if I hit tab tab, it shows me desktop documents, downloads, and Dropbox. So if I can say, okay, well, I just need the O and then the W and then another tab, and now it knows I mean downloads.
Yeah, and it won't bonk at you. So it bonks at you when it's like, I have answers, but there's more than one.
So hitting tab again, that's a nice one. The thing I use this for the most is, since I'm used to the GUI, my folder names are often normal sentence-y kind of things that have spaces in them. And instead of remembering, is it forward slash or backslash space and the path name, I just start typing and I hit tab until it fills it in for me.
Yes, and the nice thing is tab complete will properly escape all the special characters.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't. That's why I've never learned how to do it properly. But now we know we can do it in what is it? Single quotes?
Single quotes around the whole lot, or backslash in front of the funny character?
Yeah, and I don't know which one's backslash or forward slash, so I'm not going to learn that. I'll do the single
quotes.
Not the
one in URLs.
Okay.
So consider URLs as normal, so they're forward, and everything else is backwards.
And don't try to switch back and forth between Windows and Mac, or your head will explode on that.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
All
so
right.
That takes us to the end of the stuff everyone can play with, and now we have some fun on OS X. So the first thing I just want to remind people of, I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but it's worth reminding people, is that you can drag and drop things onto the terminal, and the terminal will do sane things with them. So if you drag and drop any file onto the terminal, the path to that file will get typed into the terminal. And so if you have a Finder window open and you want to copy or move a file that you see there in front of you, just type the command you want, say CD or CP or MV or whatever, and drag and drop the file onto the terminal. Or if you want to get to a folder, CD space, drag and drop the folder onto the terminal, and then hit enter. It also works with those cool proxy icons I keep preaching about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a Word document open, the icon in the title of that document is a representation of the file. And so if you drop that proxy icon onto the terminal window, the full path of the file will get typed in. And even Finder windows have proxy icons, which are the folder you're currently in. So if you have two Finder windows open, and you're in one folder in one, and you want to get to the same folder as you are in the other one, type CD space and take the proxy icon from your other terminal window. And that'll work fine.
Oh, that's interesting. In case you don't know what he means by proxy icons, he does have a screenshot where he shows you dragging the proxy icon so you can see what he's talking about. It had never occurred to me, and I know you've told me this before, but I do it to change directories, especially since I don't want to learn how to type all those little backslashes or whatever the thing that is in a URL. I don't want to learn that, so I always use it to drag a folder. I forgot you could drag a file name, and especially from within a file, like you said, a Word file. That would have never occurred to me that I could do that, even though I'm almost positive you've told me that one before, too.
Oh, I preach about it all the time. Proxy icons are my favorite hidden feature in OS X. And once you start to play with them, they're so much fun. Because if you're working on a Word document and you want to email it someone, take the proxy icon, drop it onto mail.app, and new email will start with the Word document attached.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do that all the time. Because I never remember where a bloody Excel file is that I need to send to someone.
So you drag it onto the mail icon. I guess that would assume you're using the dock or something, or you could put it...
So onto the mail icon and the dock.
Here's another thing you could do. Since you can modify a Finder window to have applications across the top, like I keep app delete
They've
there.
Taken that away.
No, they have not. I did it just...
I have never been able to add them since OS 10.9 came out.
We've talked about this because you had trouble with
That were there before stayed there for me, but I can't add new ones.
Okay. We had this conversation, Bart.
Did we?
I'm almost positive because I added Drop Shadow just recently.
I have a great big circle when I try. It says, no, you're not allowed.
Yeah, no. We figured this out, Bart. It's like you have to hold down the control key or something.
Okay, let's just cool things down. What could possibly go wrong? Control?
No. Let's... Option, maybe? Option. I bet it's option.
No, not option.
Command? Just
Oh, command. It's command. It's command.
Is it? All right. Command. Yay.
Okay.
There we go. So now I have mail up in my top bar of a Finder window. So now you're saying I can go find me any old
file.
Any file
you like. Drop it onto that icon. Mail that app will open up and a new mail will start with that attached.
And so I just go like that, and boom, mail's opening, and it's got that file attached. Look at that.
So handy.
Because that, you know what's great about that is that stops you from sending emails where you say, please find attached, and then you hit send before you attach.
Yes, exactly, because if you start with the file, it has to be there.
I like it. That's really cool.
Okay, slight diversion. Well, yes, proxy icons rock, and any folder, any file, drop it onto the terminal, its path will get typed in.
So this is something that my brother Kelly would have loved. This is his big thing was he always tried dragging and dropping things. No matter what it was he was trying to do, he loved the fact that 9 out of 10 times just dragging stuff actually did what you wanted it to do. He would love this one.
I also love the fact that a lot of apps, if you're editing stuff, like I know that... OmniGraffle that I love for doing diagrams. If you drag and drop a color, you can just drag and drop colors onto things.
Really?
It will let you drop colors, yeah.
How do you pick up
the color?
So
you have the color palette. I have my color palette open all the time.
Ah.
So I just pick the color and drop it on. It works.
Okay, I got to try that.
So anyway, yeah, drag and drop works on so much things in OS X. It rocks.
Okay.
And so proxy icons. So every terminal window has a proxy icon, and you can drop icons onto it, and it will put in the path. So there are two pieces of information for that.
Super fun.
The other thing you can do from the terminal is open files as if you had double-clicked them in the Finder. Ooh. And this is an OS X only thing, and the command in question is the very, very well-named command, open.
Okay.
And so if you find, yeah, now obviously this is a made up example, because if you have a Finder window open and you drag and drop a Finder app icon into the terminal to type open and hit enter, you're really wasting your time. You should have just double clicked. Mm-hmm. But there are many times when it's actually very useful. So a good example is, let's say you've navigated around the terminal and you've found yourself in a deep crevice of the operating system somewhere, and you finally found what you need, but you want a Finder window. Open, space, dot, enter. The Finder will open at that location.
Wait.
Dot means the current directory. Open says open it with whatever OS X thinks is the default app, and the default app for folders is Finder.
You say it one more time. Open space,
okay,
dot.
So open space dot will open the current directory that terminal window is in the Finder.
Oh, that's nice.
Now, you can also, this is also useful for getting to hidden folders, like, say, your library folder. Open /library with a capital L. Oh, look, there it is. Not hidden no more.
And I only typed LIB and then hit enter, or hit tab. Tab.
Yeah, so did I.
Look at that. That's cool.
Yeah. And as we will learn later, if you're using SSH, there's a folder you very often need to get to, which is your .ssh folder. You can get to it in the same way. So /.ssh, assuming you have SSH set up.
Hmm.
And then you can see all your public IDs and stuff.
Open tilde dot?
Open /.ssh. You may or may not have a .ssh
folder. Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Probably contains a known host file at the very least.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's every machine you've ever SSH'd to and that machine's key in a text file.
Ooh, I want to know what that says.
Well, we're going to get to that actually in our networky stuff.
Neat.
So open is useful. Now, you can also go a step further. So you can use open, give it any file path or any folder path, and it will open in the app that is the default. But what if you don't want the default? What if you actually want to take a file that doesn't have a default type and open it and text edit?
Okay.
The -a flag lets you specify the application. So if you want to edit your bash profile file, which is a very useful thing to want to do, you can type open space /.bash_profile space -a/applications/textedit.app. Again, tab complete is very much your friend here. App tab /tex tab.
I'm going to test it with my SSH file.
Oh, yeah, you can take, actually, you can drag and drop that file in, actually, if you want. Just stick the -a application text editor.
So if
editor
I say open space and then drag my known host file from SSH.
Yeah. Then space -a.
-a for the application.
Yeah, and then space slash application, so app tab.
Or I might just go over here and drag the text edit application right in.
You could do that, too. Yes, that would work, too.
That. So a combo of the two. Drag that in. The only trick is to remember to click back to the window. There it is. And boy, is that a bunch of glop I can't read. Run away,
yeah.
Run away.
Well, you can delete that if you like. It'll recreate it.
I wonder whether I'd ever want to do that.
There are reasons
not
to, actually.
So much, but...
There are reasons which we'll come to later. And actually, I've just realized I accidentally skipped over something, and this is actually a really good reason. So remember I said it might be helpful to edit your /.bash profile?
Yeah.
Well, if you remember a few minutes ago, we talked about the up arrow. What I was meant to do is tell you that the up arrow isn't always perfect. So imagine you do the same command 10 times. You have to hit the up arrow 10 times to get past it.
Right.
Because every single copy is stuck in the buffer.
Right.
That's the default behavior in OS X and the default behavior on most versions of Linux. But actually, Ubuntu Linux does something else. Ubuntu Linux doesn't save duplicates. And if you want your Mac to do that much, much more sane thing, you have to set the environment variable hist control to ignore dupes.
Okay.
And if you do that, it will only save... If it sees that the current that you're reissuing a command a second time, it won't save it a second time into the history. And so if you wanted to put that in without any like messing around with VI or Nano, you could say... Open space /.bash_profile -a applications text edit, and it will pop up in your nice GUI text editor. Mm-hmm. Then you copy and paste in the line export hist control equals ignore dupes, save, and you're done.
Hmm.
So then you have it. Now you have a GUI way of editing terminal files instead of relying on a terminal text editor like VI or Nano.
Okay.
Now, because that's something you'd like to do so often, there's a shortcut. So you don't have to type -a applications text edit. A -e means edit. in text edit.
Oh.
So you can say open tilde slash dot bash underscore profile minus E. Or so that big file that you were looking at the posts.
That's kind of unfortunate, though, since as a default, text edit is going to save it not as... It's going to save it as a formatted text file, isn't it?
Rich text? Does it?
No, it didn't.
I thought it behaved sensibly. I thought if you opened it in plain text mode, it would stay in plain text mode.
Okay,
so I was playing around with it, and I thought it was sensible.
Let's see. I'm just going to open text edit for real and just say there's a text edit file.
Let's do a command N. You probably have your rich
text.
No.
So I just opened a file that is definitely a rich text file, and it opened in rich text. But when I ran the open tilde slash dot bash profile space dash E, it did it in a non-rich text format.
Which is exactly what I hoped it would do.
Yeah. Good. For once, clever, we got lucky.
clever open command.
Yeah.
And one last thing worth mentioning about the open command is it also takes an option argument minus capital R, which means reveal in Finder.
Ooh, minus R, capital R is supposed to mean recursive.
I know.
They don't get to have it mean something else.
Well, they do. Actually, everyone gets to decide what everything means in their own command. To be honest, I don't find reveal in Finder nearly as useful because I'll just say open the folder. But anyway, I thought I'd mention it. So... that is basically the tips and tricks I had, sort of, you know, it's a show of little odds and ends.
I like it. Bits and bobs, as it were.
Bits and bobs, exactly. So that's
you know, you did
that's all I have prepared.
One in the notes.
Did I?
Right after your picture of dragging the proxy icon, you had open space
path to file
in all capital letters. Was that just an example, or that was
that's
the generic?
That's just the formal syntax, so open and then what you want to open.
Oh, okay. I was typing that in going, I'm all ready for Bart to hit the next thing. It was the explanation of open.
Okay. So path to file could be dot or tilde library or bash underscore profile, and you can open multiple things at once, right? So you could say open star.jpg and watch your computer implode.
That would be fun to do to somebody else. Run away.
I seen something a bit like that done once, where a guy was trying to prove how fast SSDs were. Oh. And so he got himself a Mac, and I think it was using FireWire, into literally a handful of SSDs, giving him gigabytes of space, if not terabytes. He booted up his Mac while physically shaking the hard disks.
Oh, jeez.
Because they're solid state, right? There's nothing moving in there. And he had a script that ran on launch, which opened 100 apps at once, which I'm sure he did with the open command.
Jeez.
And the dock icons didn't even bounce once. They just went ba-dunk, and they were open.
Wow. While
he was shaking the hard disk. It was so cool. So open is fun. And I actually use open a lot, and open dot in particular I use an awful lot.
I like it. Yeah, no, I can see what I like about these commands is they are sort of bridging the GUI and the Finder together. In the terminal together.
But see, that is the single right. I'm a Linux guy by profession, but at home I like to play on a GUI. But what makes OS X the GUI for me that I'm just not changing from is the fact that I can marry the two.
We've seen how you can choose.
But I can take my skills from one and seamlessly merge it into the GUI. So with the stuff like the automator actions that can execute Perl code or bash shell scripts, that lets me tie right-clicking onto a folder to a script I wrote on the terminal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And this drag-and-drop stuff, again, bridges that gap between the two. The open command bridges the gap between the two. You can use the terminal to interact with the clipboard, so you can send stuff from the terminal into the clipboard. Ooh. We must talk about that sometime.
Evernote?
I was just going to say Evernote. That's my next Bits and Bobs show, has the first item in it.
I like it. Well, this has been really fun, Bart. This is a nice palate cleanser. And
yes.
We haven't actually talked about when we'll talk next, but we'll chat about that when we get done here.
Yes, and who knows, I might throw in a photography show before we do taming the terminal. But next time we tame a terminal, it's going to be a propeller beanie episode, I'm afraid.
All right, well, it's good for us. So good luck next week, and I do hope people send you in some contributions.
Indeed. Thank you those who have, and please send in more. And until next time, Allison, happy computing, and enjoy your weekend off.
My daughter's wedding. My daughter's wedding. All right, bye, Bart.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks for our sponsor to helping pay the bills. Help pay the bills. Head on over to BlueBangleLearning.com or clarify-it.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. Email me at Allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter and app.net@podfeet. And don't forget to send in your submissions to Bart at podcasting@bartificer.net. .net.com. Better go check that. Wait for it. I've got it up here. Bartificer.net. Yes, it was that. All right. Be sure to check out the NoCellcast Google Plus community. I have some hard questions I've posted in there, and I could use some help. Dorothy's been getting some help from George from Tulsa with the problems she's having with her Roku. I've got a bunch of problems. I'm still trying to figure out that thing with Pat Putnam and our LastPass to 1Password tutorial, and I need some help, so I want some people to get over there to the Google Plus community. Podfeet.com/Google Plus. Post your own questions if you want, but answer my questions because I'm stuck. If you want to join in the fun of the live show that our small but lively audience did this week, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Join the friendly and enthusiastic NoCella Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.